As the attorneys, you, most of you know this so well that you don't even need to ask you, of course, but if you have not signed in, if you'd be so good to do that, we would appreciate it. And I'm sure you know that each of the cases we hear today, each side has 15 minutes to argue. And the first case on the docket is Torrey Antoine Russell versus Commonwealth. Would you like to reserve a portion of your 15 minutes for rebuttal?
3 minutes, please, Your Honor.
All right.
Before we like
you,
to
may,
step forward.
You may, proceed when you're ready.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Barbara Rosenblatt. I'm here on behalf of the Public Defender's Office representing Mr. Russell Torrey Russell. I'm here because the trial court erroneously found Mr. Russell guilty of a felonious injury to a child, and they did so through the use of inadmissible hearsay. Basically, the Commonwealth argued an excited utterance exception, which the defense objected to. And today we're here to explain the fact that this excited utterance was not, in fact, an excited utterance made by the child. The child, after being in the custody of his mother, it was found that there were some bruises on him at some point in a few-day period, unknown when, unknown by who. The child was then placed in the safe care of the father's mother for several hours. The child was then placed in the care of the father. At the time the child was in the care of the father, he then became upset and made statements about the fact that Mr. Russell had been the one that hit him. At no time during the time he was with his grandmother for several hours did he cry, did he make any statements. He was involved in the conversation. He was not acting at the grandmother's...
This is a three-year-old, right?
This is a three-year-old. That is correct, Your Honor.
And, you know, little ones can go from one thought to another rather quickly.
Yes, Your Honor.
But they can remain or get upset. They can stay upset longer over a longer period of time, can't they? So why, if when the father comes in and he inquires, you know, what happened, and the child is then crying and looking down and says, "Torrey hit me," and then when the father says, well, why would he do that, and he says, "I won't pee on myself never again, I promise I won't pee on myself," why isn't that still, if he's really upset, why isn't that an excited utterance?
Because it needs to be he needs to be in the continued state of excitement, and there was no evidence that he was in that continued state with the grandmother.
So he would have had to have stayed in a continuous state of excitement for hours and hours, or it wouldn't be ever an excited utterance.
Well, this court has actually found that hours and hours can occur as long as that statement, the child stays in that involvement, in that same condition. So it needs to be consistent. This court, in other cases where it dealt with a child who was crying overnight, Braxton v. Commonwealth, that was hours and hours. But the court said that in this situation with Braxton, that the child was clearly in a continued state because as he was passed along from one family member.
But is that absolute? Did the court say that is required in every case as a, you know, as a floor?
Well, Doe v. Commonwealth says that it needs to be continued excitement, and that condition needs to continue. Every time someone gets upset about a factor that happened however long ago, days, hours even, for excited utterance, that does not create a new excited utterance for the person to now be admissible under the excited utterance exception. It needs to be something that the child has not had the time to process, has not been able to get over. And we could be talking days when he was still in his mother's care. There was no testimony from the mother that at any time he was upset. So the child has been through multiple people that he's been involved with since this unknown incident occurred. He was with his mother at Taco Bell. He was with Mr. Russell's mother at Taco Bell. He was with his father's mother, Miss Richardson, in the car when he was talking with other passengers. And the injuries were spoken about, and he didn't cry at that point. So there was conversation about this factor. The first time the issue of injuries was addressed was not with the father. It had been addressed with the grandmother, and the grandmother on her own chose not to stop and not to do something at that point. She waited, because, which goes along with the second part of the argument with the felonious injury, it was not life-threatening. There was
counsel, in fairness, though, in terms of the facts, the grandmother said that she didn't think that she could take the child to the hospital, not only because she felt that it wasn't life-threatening, but because she wasn't essentially one of the parents that would be able to get care or give permission for treatment.
That's correct, Your Honor. However, there was no, she didn't take to any of the doctors in the box, the side places, if she felt that there was necessary care immediately. And for the felonious injury, there needs to be a serious harm to the party itself. It specifically requires there to be such endangerment in her health to the child to be injured or negligently to cause such a child to be placed in a situation that's life, health, or morals be endangered. And there was nothing that was ever done to concern this child's immediate health in any sense. Even the doctors, once the child went to the emergency room, the nurse said, okay, we're going to wait for the doctor. We don't need it.
Counsel, may I interrupt you? Now that you bring up the hospital visit, the emergency room visit, I believe, as I recall, that the child told the nurse that your client hit, and although there was an objection, the judge, as I recall, never truly ruled on that.
It's my recollection, Your Honor, that the judge ruled on the fact that who hit him was not admissible, but did not make an actual ruling on the hitting himself. So the idea of what was left unruled on by the court was the fact that the child was hit in some way, but not the fact that Mr. Russell was the one who actually hit him. So,
are you certain about that?
Your Honor, I'm fairly certain after reading the transcripts, but I would not represent to the court that I'm 100% certain. So there is the fact that at that point, as I recall, it was not released. So we still only have the fact that the father is the one who's testifying to any injuries. And the father is unable to, the father is the only way that Mr. Russell is connected to this child's injuries in any way. There's no other evidence that there was any harm done to the child by any other party that was there. And he had the opportunity multiple times to speak to multiple people outside of Mr. Russell.
Just to clarify, counsel, wasn't there, so mother went to work at Taco Bell at 10 o'clock, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And then around 2 is when, 1:30 or 2 is when appellant and appellant's mother,
yes,
took the child to Taco Bell, where he sat with mother until father's mother came and picked up the child. So, mother says she didn't see anything at that time, but grandmother saw it pretty quickly after she got in the car. So, the only person, doesn't the record show the only person who was with him after mother left that morning and until he was delivered to the Taco Bell, where numerous people saw him until grandmother picked him up, was appellant, right?
Your Honor, his grandmother was with him. The juvenile's grandmother was there, and she had contact with him for a long period of time where no one else was present, not the mother or Mr.
Russell.
You mean
after she picked him up?
After she picked him up, there were several hours,
right,
where she was present alone.
But she indicated shortly after she picked him up in the car, she saw the injuries.
She heard about the injuries, then she pulled over to the side and looked at them. Mm-hmm. But she still didn't feel that there was a necessity to make any attempts. Even, obviously, she testified she couldn't go to the hospital, but even to the emergency care, she didn't even try to do that. that.
But she saw injuries at that point.
She noticed they were bruisings on the face, but still, I would argue not to the level of a felonious injury that's required by the statute. And his health was not endangered at that point. The statute does not allow normal parenting, it does not punish appalling parenting, as stated in Shifley v. Commonwealth. So how those bruises got there, in what way, under what circumstances, that was never even stated by the child to his father, if the court finds that that would have been admissible. So there's no way to know in what way those actions occurred and whether that was in some sort of parenting situation where there were issues with the child. So that as well goes to the fact that there's nothing to show that there was the negligence or the willfulness of the felony that was convicted. But the child's statements to the father still would not be admissible because there was nothing in any way that led this child and the Commonwealth, who has the burden for the exception at this point, to show that the child continued in that state. He was talkative. He was with his grandmother, a safe person that he obviously had been with for several hours. It wasn't until his father, who had to coax this child to say what happened. The father specifically said, "I asked what happened and he looked down and started crying some more. I grabbed his hand and said, 'You're really not in trouble. Tell me what happened.'"
But Counsel Martin tells us that just because there are questions being asked doesn't mean, in fact, that it doesn't fit within the excited utterance.
That's correct, Your Honor. However, with Martin, that was 8 to 13 seconds after the incident occurred, and the party was still in the bathroom when the person came in as a general question, said what happened, and then everything was told. In this situation, it was very specific. It was not what happened, and then the juvenile said everything that happened. It was, come on, tell me a little bit more. We need to find out what happened. You're not in trouble. So where Martin, I would argue, is something that was a general question asked about a child that was on the ground in the bathroom, obviously harmed. This is a situation where we have a parent who's convincing his child to talk to me and let me know what happened. And he is getting the child upset again. So that's why it would not fall within the same, just the idea of what happened, the question itself. In this situation, I would argue that it's not an actual question. Independently, he had to convince the child and he had to talk to the child to answer that question. And that would be one of the major differences, is even though a question can be asked, it still has to be an excited utterance from that question, and this was clearly not. The boy did not want to answer. The father had to coax him into answering. You're not going to get in trouble.
Can I ask you an assignment of error to... And you're about to go into rebuttal time, I believe. But, and you might want to think about this and then answer when you come back, whichever you prefer. But talk to us a little bit about the injuries and whether you think the injuries, even if the court decided that appellant committed them, are such that fit this statute.
The injuries themselves, mm-hmm. because the only thing that was done was bruising on the child. There was no testimony in terms of how that child bruises, if the slightest contact could bruise the child, if this was done by an open hand, if a closed fist, mm-hmm. if he was backing up, if he hid into something. There were no.
It's on both sides of the face and the right. A right around the right eye.
Or if the child was being held and pay attention mm-hmm. to me. And at this point, I am going into my rebuttal time if the court would like me to step back and finish the answer.
Whichever you prefer.
Well, just the fact that this statute, the felony part of the statute, and that's what I'm dealing with, I'm not talking about a simple assault, requires more harm than that. It requires the injury, the major injury, that was never done. The grandmother waited, the nurse waited, the doctor said no follow-up, no x-rays, no nothing. And at that point, I would ask the court to allow me to step back.
Absolutely.
And thank you.
All right. Mr. Campbell, good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Aaron Campbell, and I represent the Commonwealth. Let me begin by saying that the appellant does have a pretty heavy burden in this case because the admission of hearsay is reviewed under abuse of discretion standard, as this court knows, that's highly deferential to the actions of the trial court. In fact, the Supreme Court in Clark said that even in doubtful cases, there was a presumption in favor of the trial court's actions. This is also a totality of the circumstances test. And so the issue really is whether no reasonable jurist, in considering all the circumstances in the case, could have found that this was admissible. The Commonwealth would submit that under this standard that, you know, jurists may differ, but I can't say that based on the circumstances of this case that the trial court's decision to admit this under excited utterance was so out of the realm of reasonableness. And if I could, I would like to just address some of the circumstances that the trial court considered and sort of unpack those a little bit.
Counsel, before you begin, if you could address in reference to the distinguishing elements of Martin that appellant's counsel brought up and the fact that there was the 15 seconds or so between the time when there were questions asked of the child and the response versus what we have here, which is arguably a relatively large gap of hours before father then begins asking questions of the child.
Okay, well, that's where I was going to begin anyway. I think that's probably their best factor, is that this was in response to a question. As the court's already recognized, we have Martin, we have Hicks, there's Clark also. This is the same question. What happened? I'm not sure that it matters whether it happened within 15 seconds of the event or whether it happened at the question happened later. I think the important thing is, you know, the child was obviously upset and under the stress of the excitement, and the natural reaction of a father is, what happened? And the child responded in this impulsive response that this defendant, Tori, hit me. So I don't think that it matters so much that the time period we're talking about here.
But what about the child's behavior when the child's with the grandmother, where there is no indication of crying or looking down, and the comments of the fact that he's quiet is not necessarily unusual or different? Is that a break in reference to laboring under the effects of the statement or the event?
I think a reasonable fact finder or a reasonable jurist could determine that there wasn't a break. I'm not sure there has to be a break, or that takes it out of the exception. Let me just say that. But assuming that there has to be a continuum, that he's continuing under this stress, the excitement, he certainly wasn't talking to the grandmother. She's asking him. My recollection of the transcript is that he wasn't talking to her. Now, she did say that wasn't unusual for him, but he certainly wasn't talking to her about what happened. And when he sees his father, who is his primary guardian, he looks down. He is, which is unusual for him, and he was crying and visibly upset. So, you know, as Judge Beal sort of alluded to, when we're talking about a 3-year-old. A 3-year-old, their emotions can change, you know, quickly and in different ways. But
suppose it had been the next day. And we're looking at a time frame, and as you said, this is a small child, so emotions can change quickly. But suppose this were the next day. When do we get out of the period where it can't be an excited utterance anymore because too much time has passed?
I mean, it's tough. If the evidence showed that the child has been withdrawn for a full day and upset and not his normal self, you know, if the evidence is the next day the child, you know, gets up and he's happy and he's having a good time, and then something triggers him and then he's upset, perhaps the excited utterance would not apply. I think in this case, with the lapse of time, I think we have to look at the evidence in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, including all inferences. As the court's already talked about, the child was with the defendant from 10 to about 2:30. And it is Commonwealth's contention that's likely when this occurred, considering the freshness of the bruises. And so it's just a window of a matter of hours. And I would take exception that he was with the grandmother for several hours. It was from about 2:30 to 4, which was not a long time. It was just enough time for the father to make it off.
Father gets home from work about 4, right?
Right. That's what time he got home.
Mr. Campbell, following up on a question that Judge Chaffin had asked earlier, in terms of the record where there was a statement given to the nurse about what happened and who was responsible for it, it appears the court doesn't rule on whether that can come in or not come in. Do you have a position on that?
Yeah, I've looked at it a number of times because I think if that statement had gotten in, I think we would have argued harmless error quite strongly.
Your position, that the court ruled on that?
Well, what the court did was they argued that it was an excited utterance and it fell under the medical exception for a diagnosis. And on page 66 of the appendix, the court seemed to say that, well, I don't have enough before me to rule that this was an excited utterance, not necessarily for the medical, but it didn't seem like he actually made a ruling that this was admitted or not, but I think
what's the Commonwealth's position
I think probably a fair interpretation of that is that the statement to the nurse was not admitted.
And how do you conclude that? If the court didn't make a complete ruling on it, then it came in. It seemed to me like. So tell me how, Mr. Campbell, you reached that conclusion. Just looking at it, I looked back.
You know, it's hard to say. I mean, maybe I'm being too deferential to my opponent here.
we appreciate that.
We appreciate your candor.
I mean, I would say on page 179, where they come back after the briefing, and the only thing the court said was, I find that the statement to the father is admitted. He didn't say anything about the nurse. I've read this, the court's ruling on, I think it's page 66 of the appendix, a number of times. And
he does say at the bottom of 65, but I just don't think at this point I've heard evidence that would indicate that even considering the age, we are still within that framework of spontaneous or impulsive.
Right.
And then he starts wandering a bit before he finishes his sentence, which all of us have been known to do.
Yeah, after that's the part that I just wasn't quite sure what he's...
About the purpose of the diagnosis or the treatment.
For the... yeah.
Not necessarily, though, for the purpose of the diagnosis or the treatment.
For the... I mean, is he saying it's admitted under the medical exception or not?
That's what it would seem to be.
It would seem to be. That's what... I've went back and forth on that, but... if the court wants to say that's it,
we want it. Want you to tell us.
can we go a little bit to the second assignment of error and looking at the statute?
Okay.
Parsing the words of 40-1-103. What do you say of these injuries? The bruising to the face. Particularly around the right eye, the scratch on the left cheek. I guess there's a contusion of some sort inside. I believe it's the left cheek. Is that right?
Yes, it's in the cheek. It's all the way through.
And then there was something about it bruising to an arm, maybe too.
I think there was bruising on the arm from likely a grab.
What under the statute? I mean, certainly for battery, you've got it. What under the statute says that this place his health, such child to be placed in a situation that its health may be endangered? Tell me exactly where you think the wording of that statute covers this.
You know, as the court's well aware, it's a broad statute. It covers a lot.
Yeah.
A swath of behavior. What I would ask the court to look at is the language, willfully, negligently to cause or permit the health of such child to be injured, Certainly this child was injured.
Mm-hmm. So it's not just an injury to the child. It's so if you have any sort of injury, then your health is injured.
Yeah.
You see, where my question is going to the fact that you have the doctor saying, well, you know, we don't need any follow-up here. I'm not in any way trying to minimize the injuries to the child, but just trying to see if it fits under this statute, and the doctor saying, yeah, you don't need to bring him back or we do anything further. He's going to be all right. But
well, then the statute at the end of the statute also says, or to cause or permit such a child to be, and it has a number of things, beaten or cruelly treated.
And I looked at that too. Isn't that, though, traditionally or normally used in the context of a work environment or something like that in most of the cases?
How so? I'm not quite sure I understand.
Well, I mean, a number of the cases that have used that part of the statute indicate it's where someone has been overworked, abused at work, mistreated there. I don't know why it couldn't be, yeah, as I read it.
Man, this is a child,
right,
talking about work.
Right. It's not the 3-year-old child labor laws, but
right.
So, but still, I'm just, that part, the very last part, beaten or cruelly treated, would seem to perhaps deal with the situation.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not what I gathered had been argued before, and maybe I'm mistaken on that.
It was certainly in the indictment. Mm-hmm. All this language.
All the language.
All the language,
right,
is in the indictment. So, I checked this morning, yes.
Mm-hmm.
I just think that, you know, plainly striking a child in the face and the child's injured would fall under, you know, either this is endangering the child's health, or, you know, it's cruelly, you know, it's,
given the nature of the bruises and the repeated blows that have been required to cause these injuries, repeated blows or grabbing.
It's not, under a medical sense, life-threatening, but...
Right,
it's,
but it just doesn't say it has to be life-threatening either.
No, it doesn't have to be life-threatening, not at all.
Okay.
Let me just quickly, at 2 minutes, point out that, again, we're talking about age here. The child is 3 years old. Young children are less likely to fabricate, and also that the stress of the excitement lasts longer in children.
I'm not sure I accept that counsel, that children are less likely to fabricate, although I know that we have case law that backs that up. But, you know, ultimately, children at the age of 3 many times don't know the difference between truth or falsity or right or wrong. But I understand it's backed up by case law. I read the same cases you read, so.
Right, right. I'll say that the case law has said that.
And of course, here the issue, have father reporting all of this to us, which credibility is decided by the fact finder.
Mm-hmm.
But father has reasons to perhaps want to not have the situation with mother and her boyfriend result in custody or joint custody of the child. So, you know, all this is coming from someone who may have other interests as well.
Certainly, but you have to be, I would say, viewed in the light, Mr. to the Commonwealth, that whatever potential bias is a matter for the fact finder. The fact finder found that the father was credible. Also, this was a shocking event. I mean, you know, getting punched in the face is a shocking event. And I've talked a little bit already about his demeanor, especially when he was talking to his father. And I understand, Judge Mallow, your question of whether or not he exhibited those same behavior with the grandmother. He certainly was, at least a reasonable jurist could say that he was withdrawn. You know, this is it's not an easy case. It's quite difficult. It's a shame that this wasn't held later, because now we have a statute that basically, and rule of evidence, that would cover this a little better. But I think under the totality of the circumstances, a reasonable jurist may differ, but I don't think that the trial court is ruling and he definitely took a lot of time to consider this and made a thoughtful consideration that this was unreasonable and that the trial court abused his discretion. Unless the court has questions, I'd ask that the court affirm.
Any further questions, Mr. Campbell? Thank you, Mr. Campbell. Ms. Rosenblatt, you have your rebuttal time.
Thank you. There are a few quick things I'd like to address that the Commonwealth and the court both dealt with. First, the lapse of time. There's been this assumption that it happened within the few hour period that Mr. Russell was with the child alone on that day, but no one had had contact with this child for 2 days before that, and the mother, who was the last one to have contact with the child, said there were no bruisings. So there's no way to know when this bruising actually occurred. It was seen 2 days after the child left the custody. There was testimony that it was fresh bruising, but to what extent fresh bruising is the next day, is that fresh bruising? There was no testimony in terms of that. So the lapse of time cannot be assumed to be within that short period of time, those 2 hours. In addition, the court noted that there's a change.
Those 2 hours. Can you tell me what you're talking about? Which 2 hours?
The 2 hours that Mr. Russell was with the child alone.
Oh, I thought it was like 4 hours.
The morning of that the child was alone. But the mother still testified that at no time, so there's nothing to say that the bruising hadn't occurred the day before. And the court noted that a child's demeanor quickly changes back and forth. Well, every time it changes back to being upset does not create a new situation of an excited utterance. It needs to be continuing, and that's the necessary thing. So a child can get upset, he can calm down, he can get upset again, he can calm down, but those next times he gets upset, it's not an excited utterance when he comes back and he's pushed into saying things. Even when he just says it alone, it's going through an emotional up and down, but excited utterance is the continued feeling and that continued event that the child clearly doesn't have. When he's in the car with the grandmother, there's nothing that shows that this is completely strange demeanor out of the way that he's never exhibited before. And she testifies to the fact that he, you know, was involved. He was not crying at any time she saw
him. She didn't really ask him, gosh, what happened to you?
The other parties in the car were talking about what happened, and the child did not cry. Mm-hmm. So the topic itself was being addressed. She was not the one who said it, but this was a topic that was still the child had to face at that time, and he wasn't crying. He wasn't making any upsetting statements or crying or showing the grandmother in any way that there was an issue at that point. It's not until later. So clearly at that point, he was in an environment where he was faced with the situation he was faced with his father, yet he was calm because at this point, that emotion, whenever it happened over the past 2 days, it's unknown. And he had calmed down, he had finished, and then the father may have gotten him excited again, but that does not create a new excited utterance. So for that reason, I would present to the court that the case should be overruled and reversed. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Rosenblatt. We will greet counsel, and then the next case on the docket is Jane Arlene Frakes versus Danny Joe Frakes. All right.